This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Kira Ochoa. She's Healthcare Assistance Program Manager for Santa Fe County, and Mark Boschelli, who is a licensed medical health counselor and substance abuse counselor for Presbyterian Medical Services. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And we're here to talk about something called the Mobile Crisis Response Team. What is that? What's it all about?
The Mobile Crisis Response Team is where we have a two-member licensed mental health team that will go to the scene working with law enforcement, either Santa Fe County Sheriff, Santa Fe Police Department, or fire departments, and help out in those situations where there might be a mental health emergency. So we're available 24 hours a day to go anywhere in the county of Santa Fe. We usually arrive at the scene within 20 minutes and help the police or the fire department ascertain what's going on with the situation. When they know it's not something that's can be really resolved with an arrest or brought to the hospital.
How do the emergency responders figure out in the first place that they need you?
Well, it's actually been a process since July 1st where we went around for Presbyterian Medical Services and trained up all the sheriff's department, police department, all their different shifts, as well as the fire departments, and said that if you're on the scene and you notice that someone might be behaving in a way that's kind of peculiar, whether it's substance abuse or a mental health, or they're talking to themselves, kind of that type of descriptors, as the first responders would basically tell us, we don't know what to do with this situation. That's the time to call us to the scene.
There have been cases, I don't know about in Santa Fe County, but there have been cases across the country, and not a year goes by where I don't read one or two of them, where police are called in to somebody who has a mental health problem or a suicide attempt, and the cops end up killing the person who needs the help. And those are tragic cases that arise from a lack of training. And of course, it's a completely different training and in a sense, different personality type between counselors and cops.
Exactly. The police, rightly so, they want to protect the citizens from something ill will being achieved against them. Mental health therapists, we kind of want to see what's going on. In Santa Fe, actually, we have a long history, and you know, I've been around long enough to remember back in the early 90s where we actually had a situation where the Santa Fe Police Department did kill somebody who was threatening to harm themselves.
Yeah.
And as a result, the Santa Fe Police Department has been pretty interested most of the time, kind of saying, we don't want to arrest this individual. Something's going on. Is there a way that mental health professionals can assist us at the scene? And there is plenty of press around the nation of mentally ill individuals who are crying out for help, family members crying out for help. Law enforcement shows up, and unfortunately, there's a tragic event that occurs, and it's usually that person with mental illness who dies. One of our goals here is to prevent that type of tragic situation throughout our county of Santa Fe. So it's a pretty progressive program in that
yeah,
way.
Very much so. I mean, even if the person with the mental health problem doesn't die, there's a lot of incarceration of mentally ill people.
Yes, our jail is overflowing with people who have mental illness, and unfortunately our system is not well resourced enough to really handle that. And this is a wonderful project that we're very happy that Santa Fe County Community Services Department can support, because it's one thing that's needed in a whole continuum and a whole system, and it's really doing a great job. The team at Presbyterian has been called out on 171 times. I've seen people 171 times since they began in July.
And just this July?
Yes.
Oh,
and
my
so
goodness.
They really were off and running after all the training that Mark mentioned, which was very well received by various first responders in the county. They've really started seeing people on scene, but also, and Mark can talk more about this, getting people plugged into what resources we have to help them so they don't get to that crisis point. Certainly the county has an interest in keeping people out of our jail who don't belong in jail, but we also have a responsibility for public safety that goes beyond just incarcerating a mentally ill person.
As a person who's essentially working on that kind of a response unit, you're essentially a mental health first responder. How do you go into a situation? What's it like to evaluate people you've never met who are in crisis? You don't know the situation, you don't know their family, there are safety issues.
Welcome to the job.
Yeah.
Ready, go. That's basically, they're cold calls. In other words, we get just a little bit of information from, say, the sheriff's department. We have this individual who's threatening to harm themselves. The family's calling. We're at the scene. So usually we'll wait for the sheriff's department, police department, to secure the scene, to make it safe.
Now, is it usually somebody who's threatening to harm themselves?
Yeah. A lot of times, or they're either talking to themselves or kind of scaring the neighbors, you know, maybe talking out loud when no one's around. And the neighbors know something's going on in that household. We're not sure. So it can be domestic violence or a mental illness or profound substance use. We'll wait for the law enforcement to secure the unit, the area. We walk in immediately. We're civilians. We don't have flashing, you know, lights or cars or jackets.
Or guns.
We're purposely armed with just basically our skills as counselors. And that means a two-member team, one person will immediately talk to the law enforcement officer to try to get and ascertain as much information as possible. What's the age, race, cultural background of the individual, and what's going on according to their viewpoint. The other counselor will probably just walk right into the scene and start talking. So you have to establish what's called rapport immediately. You know, kind of bond with the person in need. A lot of times there's family members. The other partner will start bonding with the family members to get their viewpoint that's going on. And what we've found out that just being open and reasonable and non-threatening, you know, we kind of pride ourselves in thinking, what would it be like for these two mental health people just to show up on someone's doorstep? And we always kind of have that perspective. You know, we don't want to be loud and boisterous. Actually, we want to be calm, cool, and collected, and caring. And really emanate that continuously throughout the process. That seems to calm everybody down, you know, whether it's people with badges or the EMTs. And we're like, let's see what's going on. Let's slow the situation down. And really, our goal is to see what's going on from the perspective of the individual need. You know, family members might say one thing, but the individual need might say, no, I'm fine. I'm perfectly fine. I don't need to go anyplace. Get out of my house, you know, sometimes. But we'll just, you know, take our time and just see from the perspective of that person in need. A lot of times we're able to successfully divert somebody from going into the emergency room. Prior to this program, the EMTs and police department would just immediately pick up the person, put them inside the ambulance with their approval, bringing them to an emergency room. And a lot of times, there really wasn't a good disposition. You know, nothing really happened. They got a little bit of an evaluation, but then they were sent back home. Our goal is to divert them from either going into the hospital or the detention center for no reason, and to actually actively link them up to outpatient services.
What do you do when you have a person who says, you know, I'm fine, you guys are making a huge fuss over nothing, and the family says, that's not true?
That's around half the cases we've gone out on in that type of situation. So our goal is to tell the family members, well, you know, this person is not usually in need of hospitalization. In other words, they're not threatening to kill themselves right there or kill somebody else. They're not actively doing anything. But clearly there's evidence of a mental illness. And we'll do training right on the spot, both for law enforcement or the EMT, saying, I think this is what we're seeing. I think this is the mental illness that possibly is going on, whether it's depression or some type of thought disorder. We'll also educate the parents right there on the spot, or the loved ones. The client, basically, a lot of times we have backed out of those situations. We've said, you know, there's no need to bring them to the hospital. but there's clearly something going on. And I'll tell you what we'll do. And we do this little technique of we give them a card and say, hey, is it okay if we keep in contact with you? So it's this benign, you know, friendly encounter that no one gets arrested. The family isn't too happy sometimes, but we kind of dissipate the scene. So everyone leaves, but the following day, we're going to show up again to see if we can talk to the person when that situation's a little bit more calm.
And after some sleep.
After some sleep, usually some calories brought into their system. Sometimes they'll still say, no, I'm not interested. But we've been amazed at around 85% of the contacts that we've had. Individuals have said, okay, well, maybe I do need something. And then we've helped them come in on their own volition, on their own abilities to come into our outpatient programs. So we're purposely not trying to push in a negative way. And that joining, once again, that's from the establishment of that relationship. We've watched people come into our clinic that would normally not get linked up to services at all.
I would think that when somebody comes in of their own volition, whatever services or therapies they might get would be more effective.
That's how I was trained, is, you know, how can I sell this idea that, yeah, you need counseling, and you know, maybe your family might be a little bit happier if you were kind of back on your medications or consider medications. A lot of times we're able to join with the client in that fashion. They might decide, okay, I'll start these medications so my family gets off my back. And that's perfectly fine. We don't really care where the decision is made. But it's, once again, it's the joining, and they make their own decisions. So we have the ability to help involuntarily hospitalize people, but that usually doesn't turn out too well.
Why not? Because, I mean, for that same reason, they don't want to be there. They're not going to be responding.
Right. For the opposing part to this is that you did this against my will. I didn't want to come in. If they go into the hospitals for a short period of time, and we're always thinking about the long game. What might be pretty right there to throw someone into the hospital usually does not have the best outcome. But if we slow down the situation and do many home visits over the next couple weeks and then slowly convince the person to come into outpatient services, the follow-up rate is very high. And, you know, once again, we achieve what everyone's trying to achieve. You know, we've helped someone get into mental health services. The family's stress usually goes down because they see that their loved one is getting services. Law enforcement is ecstatic because usually they've been out to these individuals and their addresses numerous times. And for the first time, they're starting to see that, wow, we're not getting so many 911 calls to that address.
Right. Yeah, they must have this here we go again mentality towards their, very interesting. So we're talking about the mobile crisis response team. Now, you, Mark, are a licensed therapist, counselor, both substance abuse and mental health, and you, Kira, are working for the county, and I would imagine that when you are putting together a team of mental health practitioners to go out on these calls, you have to have quite a lot of experience. I mean, you wouldn't put somebody fresh out of graduate school onto that team, is my guess.
Well, it's a guess. I would kind of say no. It's
really
the opposite. They're usually partnered with someone who's has some history working with mental health cases. Everybody on our mobile team that rotates through is trained. I do a 20-hour training to bring them up to the skill level that we need, both the newer people as well as the more experienced people. Sometimes a new graduate out of graduate school, whether it's master's or doctor level, is enthused, is interested in trying to do this work. So that's why I try to tap into some of that energy. You know, I'm old and kind of crusty. I've been doing this for 30 years. You know, I want someone who has kind of an interest in saying, I think we can do something to help these individuals out.
Right.
So we have a myriad of different experiences for our team members. But the one area that's across the board is they're part of the Presbyterian Medical Services service delivery system. They're invested in the idea that people need to be linked up to services. And most are already carrying their own caseload or they have case management abilities. So they already know that the goal is not just the crisis intervention. it's also that follow-up linkage that really pays off for everybody in the long run.
I think the other strength of the Presbyterian Medical Services team is the cultural competence that they bring. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but it seems like most of your staff, many people are from the communities that they're being called out to. They know them intimately. They know just very well how to communicate. They don't need special training in cultural competence because these are people from the community.
Most have been around for a long time. You know, I've been around for around 3 decades in northern New Mexico. We have Spanish language capability for individuals or families that have interest more speaking in Spanish than English. But we're here. We live here. We're invested in the community. You know, this is not a big money venture at all. It's kind of the opposite. Everyone who comes onto the mobile team is invested in basically the cutting edge of bringing behavioral health, mental health, and substance abuse services right to the community. You know, I don't sit in my office and wait for my clients to come in, and I'm always out in the community. I'm visiting lots of people's homes. I see their environments. I see, sometimes very poor environments, financially poor, as well as just the hygiene area for those individuals. It gives me all the information I know that they're having a troubling time. That helps us. You know, within 20 seconds, we've scoped out the environment. We pretty much know how to work with that individual. So that purposely, we'll train up each and every member of the team. I've also been a professor at the Law Enforcement Academy teaching new cadets how to work with mentally ill people in crisis situations. So I also have that law enforcement background. When I first came out of graduate school, I had to ride along with police officers for 2 months in my other program back in Illinois. So I'm sensitive to how law enforcement, they're kind of trained in a way. Mental health counselors are trained in a different way, but there's a bridge in between we can get to.
Is it required for police cadets? Is it part of their training to have mental health training? I mean, is that a...
It is, and there was actually an expansion, but now it's kind of cut back a little bit, is to recognize that most situations, and it's really around 50% of their situations dealing with the public, have to do with mental health emergencies. Whether
is that right? 50%?
50%
of police called out on calls?
Yes. The same thing is asked to fire departments, whether it's the Santa Fe County Fire Department or the Santa Fe City Fire Department. Ask them when they last dealt with a fire, and they're like, oh, no. We deal with heart attacks and then substance abuse, mental health issues. We just happen to have red trucks, when I was teaching at the Law Enforcement Academy, I mean, these are brand new cadets, and, they're all excited about, going out and writing tickets to people and arresting people. And, and I'm like, well, actually, you're never going to pull your weapon. But what you will utilize is the skills to communicate to individuals in need. So it was always a letdown when I had my week of training with the cadets. They're like, oh, anything but him. But on the other hand,
they weren't interested?
No, not totally. But I would meet up with the cadets as they became seasoned officers and move up the ranks, and they would kind of say, you're pretty right about that. Thank God I listened a little bit. And that's why, actually, in Santa Fe County, it's a rare event that a mentally ill person has had a tragic endpoint. It's very exciting to see that throughout Santa Fe County, there's a progressive thought process going, these are people in need. How do we help them? And that's why when the county came up with this proposal of funding a mobile crisis response team, I was ecstatic. My staff weren't too excited. They knew what 24-hour call meant. But, we were able to sell the idea that we can do something right there on the spot. And many of the members of the mobile team have already said, they've been doing counseling for 10 to 15 years, and actually this is the first time they feel like they're doing something for an individual.
And we've heard the same sort of thing from first responders, that they're very, very gratified to have this resource, that it helps them not go out to the same site multiple times when it's clearly not their help that's really needed at that point. But I think we're very fortunate in Santa Fe that we have a very progressive community, and our first responders are very well trained and caring people for the most part.
When you were talking before about how firemen don't get a chance to put out fires very often, you realize that part of the reason for that is that building codes have improved a lot, building materials have improved a lot, people have fire extinguishers, the kind of safety that you learn in school as a kid about, you know, cooking and not playing with matches or whatever, all that kind of stuff that we learned has actually worked and resulted in prevention of fires. When you look at mental health from the perspective of prevention, what could families do, individuals do, communities do, schools, health services, to actually prevent the kinds of situations that do result in emergency calls?
Well, it seems to be education, education, education. Families that have someone in need with mental illness, I usually refer them to the Santa Fe chapter of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. They run a 20-week course on understanding mental illness and how to work with that individual as a family member. In the schools, currently we run a couple teen health centers in Santa Fe High as well as Capitol High, where we work with teenagers. We screen them for depression. There's a lot of information these days talking about what it's like to be depressed. It's a little bit different as an adolescent compared to an adult. So making sure that people, that there's no stigma, a negative stigma of going into services to get help. You have some of the individuals, when Robin Williams took his life, a lot of good education came out of that. You know, here's his loved comedian, and then you find out that he had a long history of profound depression, and he was treating that with both antidepressant medications as well as therapy. It just, unfortunately, he went through a bad spell. So that part is very helpful to get out the correct information to individuals, as well as going through a mental health crisis is treatable. I mean, we have very, very good success rates of treating individuals, and to the point where they can go back to work, go back to their families, and enjoy themselves. Getting that word out has been a little bit more difficult, but the treatment records are quite astoundingly good.
I think the other issue is how far upstream do we want to go? As a community, we need to invest in behavioral health resources for our people. It's part of not seeing it as a stigma, seeing it as a priority, but for everybody in the community, not just the mentally ill person, not just their family. I think people are afraid of mental illness, and so sometimes there's a, you know, standoffishness, but that certainly shouldn't be happening when we start carving out our state budgets, for example, or even our community county level funding sources. We really need to think of this as something we're all in together. And the other issue, I think, going even more upstream, is when you live in a stressful environment where you can't get a job and, you know, your prospects are not what they could be, that can trigger a lot of pre-existing proclivities to mental illness. And I think we need to think about a healthy community, and we need to think about mental health as very much part of overall health. It's not a subset, really. It's not a, you know, it's not, it shouldn't be in its own little silo. It's all of a piece.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I think about the relationship between, for example, campaign finance reform and mental health. If you think about how the...
Help me out here.
Yeah.
I like it. I like where you're going, but I have no idea
I'm
where that is.
I'm trying not to go there.
Okay. Here's what I think about that. If you think about how the lack of campaign finance reform has led to the ever-increasing concentration of wealth in the hands of very few, that leads to ever-worsening working conditions and ever-lower wages relative to the cost of living, which is depressing. And it also leads to the inability of people to eat well and recreate well and things like that. I mean, when you have situations of extremes of wealth and poverty, that leads to every kind of ill health, including mental health.
I think we need to be careful about we need to be clear that people who have, for example, schizophrenia or who are bipolar are, you know, they're very much dealing with a very particular illness that they need particular treatment for. And that's important to acknowledge, that professionals like Mark and his team are really needed in those cases. And I know that's not, you're not saying otherwise.
And those things aren't caused by upward flow of wealth, but the treatment of them is hindered by a process that doesn't allow for enough government services.
Yeah, I think when we start thinking about government services for these issues, both in terms of prevention, recognizing early signs, you know, having our communities be healthy places generally that don't trigger stressful responses, and we think about people calling 911 50% of the time as canaries in a mine, really. But I think the issue of resources is where Santa Fe County came in, and luckily we're a well-resourced county, you know, and we're able to fund something like this. But you know, if you go out to more rural areas where there aren't these kind of county level resources, we really need some leadership from the state to help us throughout our state in places where people are hurting and don't have these kind of programs. And we need more even here than we have. We could triple and double and clone Mark's team and still have need.
Yeah, getting linked to services has been really a difficulty for most people that I know of. And they'll talk about, I tried calling this agency, couldn't get in, which is why they're going to call 911. They're going to say the phone gets answered. There's a caring person. No, my house is not on fire, and no, I you know, no one's burglarizing my place. But I want to know how to get help, and that's why we've worked very closely with the 911 system. They help dispatch our mobile team to go through the county. It's been a nice partnership with them. They're excited because they've had numerous repetitive phone calls to 911, even sometimes asking, you know, what day of the week it is, time is it.
Oh, my goodness.
And unfortunately, that can eat up our 911 time.
Right.
When someone really needs an emergency. So we've been able to target those individuals through this program as well as a city program for those repetitive callers to get them linked up to the services that are needed.
One of the things you were mentioning before is culturally sensitive care. And a lot of people who are on this response team are from the community and understand the community. Tell us more about that. What does culturally sensitive care look like? Like, how would you respond to one family different from another family depending on what the cultural context was?
Well, Northern New Mexico, you know, we're going to be respectful that, you know, if it's usually it's an extended family system, which on one hand is exciting to see family members there. On the other hand, sometimes everyone gets in everybody's business, and we have to recognize that. From where I came from, there was no families left in the Midwest, but here there's extensive families. We have to be respectful to, you know, the patron of the family, but also know that mom holds the power. So culturally, we're pretty much aware to who to talk to, how to talk to the individuals. Secondly, you know, we know that we're imposing in coming into a family system. Our goal is not to order people around, quite the opposite. There's been a couple times where we've actually broken bread during a meal with a family as they're talking about their loved one. And of course, the tortillas were flying, you know, the beans were made, and we're talking about, you know, how do we get Jose back into services? By participating in a meal with the family was a sensitive way of doing it, instead of having everybody come to a sterile medical office and then saying, you know, we need to do. Quite the opposite. So,
and not a bad deal for your team either.
Yeah, you know, we get fed once in a while. we get pretty excited about that.
Well, receiving somebody's hospitality is a sign of gracious courtesy.
Yes. And that's being absolutely respectful. We're not trying to be the medical practitioners who say either you're not doing something or this needs to be done. We basically will join in. So we do have examples where we're still working with individuals and families. We've talked to them. We've said, it does look like that person does have a mental illness. They seem to be talking to themselves. We understand that you're part of you have a compound around, and we don't want to banish that individual, but we think services would be better for that individual. So we've had some family meetings, both at the office as well as on the scene, and slowly we're approaching that person in need. And usually we want to be introduced by the person that they have the best relationship with, not the one that they're kind of thinking is out to get them. So sometimes, you know, if anything, we're going to be faulted that we're not doing quick enough work, but we actually want to do work that's helpful to everybody involved.
And that's another sign of cultural competence, because if you're in a hurry, you're in the wrong state.
That is so true.
You're going to do it right, you know, and I think this team is very much doing it right.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing about that Mark is mentioning, it's really a group effort and a group consciousness in New Mexico that I think Hispanic and Native cultures here have long, from what I've been told, understood that it's not about an individual, that an individual may be expressing, you know, something for the group, and the group's need to be well is important just as much as that individual's need. So I think the team knows that and operates accordingly.
Now, what are the types of mental illness that are most common in northern New Mexico in Santa Fe County?
Santa Fe County is the second leading county with completed suicides in the state of New Mexico, as well as state of New Mexico's run second regarding completed suicide rates.
Completed suicides, meaning as opposed to a suicide attempt where the person survives.
Yes. Yeah, so there's a big difference regarding that. It's usually 5 to 8% of the population. So think about our county. What's our population?
144,000.
144,000. She just happened to have that right off the top of her head. So look at 5 to 8% of those individuals have major mental illness, whether it's depression, they've lost energy, lack of interest, thinking of suicide. In addition, there's schizophrenia, a thought disorder where you hear voices, you get very paranoid of people around you, as well as bipolar illness where you have profound ups and profound depressions. So it's around 5 to 8% of our populace. Now, that's not any more different than any county in the state of, basically the United States.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's the same rates. However, we have this overlying substance abuse issue that seems to really bring it to the forefront, whether it's abuse of heroin or other opiates, as well as alcohol, that seems to make these individuals really come to the forefront of law enforcement. And like I'm saying, 50% of the contacts with law enforcement here in the city proper of Santa Fe, as well as county, basically are involving some type of behavioral health issues, substance abuse and or mental health. So that's why it's kind of interesting to see how much interactions actually take place from our first responders. You know, once again, you know, EMTs will say, I know how to handle a heart attack. But someone who's talking to themselves and wandering in the middle of the streets, unclothed, I don't really know what to do with that individual.
Right, right. Now, that's an extreme case. Wandering the streets naked, what do you do? Mark shows up on the scene.
I wish it was an extreme case, but okay, so
it's not an extreme case?
No.
That happens every week?
Yeah, last week, yeah.
Okay.
So we had a person who was distraught and literally laying in the middle of the street of a residential area, unclothed.
In February.
Yeah, that's kind of difficult, but yes. And the police were like, so they called the city of Santa Fe Police Department as well as EMTs. They called our mobile crisis response team, and they're saying, what do we do? You know, we can manhandle this person, arrest them, but we're like, we don't want to arrest them. We don't want to put them in our detention centers. They've had enough education to know that our Santa Fe County Detention Center is the largest psychiatric hospital here in the county. And unfortunately, they don't have the treatment to be able to work with those individuals. So they asked what to do. So we sat there talking to the person. Literally, I know it's cold out and the person's disrobed. And we're like, you know, it's getting a little bit cold. So we just started talking. So we asked law enforcement, just stand around us, and EMTs, stand around. And we started going, how about let's put that bathrobe back on? And as simple as that. And I was like, oh. And we don't know if it was just a change of new people coming into the environment. And a lot of times that's all it is a caring nature of individuals coming in. We don't have any badges or really snappy uniforms. You know, we're civilians. And we asked the person to get clothed. And then we asked the person, you know, do you usually take medications? And this person was like, well, yeah, but I'm not taking them right now. And so we determined in partnership with the police department as well as the paramedics that we're just going to walk this person back to their apartment. So we're not going to swoop them up and bring them to the hospital. But we told them we'll follow up the next day. And so the person agreed, okay, I want to go in my apartment. It happens to be down the street. So the person became a little bit more coherent in working with us. So they're cooperative. All of us together, EMTs, fire department, were able to walk the person back to their apartment. We kind of looked around. We gained entrance. The person allowed us in. And we said, oh, these are your meds right here. It seems like you haven't taken your dosage here tonight. Would you mind taking your dosage? The person agreed. Then we said, hey, is it okay that we're not going to take you to the hospital, but we're going to show up the next day? And the person's like, what? You're going to show up again? And we're like, yeah.
Positive? Like, yeah, wow, you care enough
astounded,
to show up again?
Astounded, yeah. Actually. So we dismissed, the fire department dismissed themselves, law enforcement dismissed, and they were happy. No one had too much paperwork. Basically, we left the scene. So all the flashing lights dissipated away. So that was a diversion away from the hospital emergency room. Well, the next day, our mobile team went out to go visit this person. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. And utter failure. In other words, we are knocking on this person's door. Not a sign of anything. The curtains are open. We're like, oh, boy, we blew this one. So no contact the next day. The following day, we tried again to visit again during our rounds of driving around the neighborhood. No contact at all the next day. We're like, oh, boy. But the third day, all of a sudden, we knocked, still no contact. We were about getting into our cars when this person actually called our cell phones. We had left our cards. And then this person's like, was that you knocking at my door? Because I'm really afraid of people. I'm like, yes, we were trying to get you into our clinic. And this person said, you really did come. You really? And we're like, yeah, we told you we're going to come here. So the person agreed to be transported to our clinic. We got that person into seeing our psychiatrist. We did an intake, got him to see the psychiatrist, and back on the appropriate medications. And that person started seeing our therapist as well as case managers on an outpatient basis. So it seems low-key, seems like it wasn't all that exciting of an event, but, in that story was a crisis team showing up on the scene, helping out with law enforcement, helping to assess what's going on. Everyone got diverted away from the hospital or the detention center, and then successful linkage. And that's really kind of the hallmark of our team these days. This is really what we're priding ourselves in doing.
When I hear that story, one of the things I hear is the cost to society is so much less than it would be if that person went to jail, went to hospital, if the police took a blunt object and knocked down their door to make sure they were really there, and the cost of all those repairs, the cost of that trauma. All of those things are avoided.
That's right.
And I'm going to guess that if you did the big picture math, that these kinds of response teams would actually save untold sums of money and untold amounts of trauma and suffering.
I would conjecture exactly that This is what helps all of us out. You know, there's no big bills for anybody, no big crises. You know, we don't have our law enforcement negatively characterized in the media, and it's a win-win situation for everybody involved.
Law enforcement can do what they do best.
Yes. It's really, it is a cost-benefit analysis, and it's much better to prevent a visit to the ER or visit to the jail, you know, than to have that person go in. And many of these people go through multiple times. You know, they're high utilizers of the ER and of the jail, and our system just can't afford that. So a little bit of leverage here prevents a lot of cost down the line. And, you know, if nothing else, it's an economic benefit. But it's a lot more, obviously, than just an economic benefit. It's, you know, it's basically the kind of community and society we want to be, and it's cost-effective.
Yeah, it's idealistic, but in the long run, it's hugely cost-effective. We've diverted an emergency room contact of $1,000, no hospitalization of $15,000, or a jail of, you know, a couple hundred dollars experience, plus the individual. This individual was willing to follow up and took the bus themselves to our clinic. After that first contact, we didn't have to go out anymore. And clearly, when we showed up on the scene, the police were, you know, they rolled their eyes a little bit going, oh, is this person again? And you can tell, you know, they were frustrated. And of course, when we said, well, let us talk to this person, they're like, what? We're like, let's give it. But the police were very good. They were absolutely supportive. They were like, wow, okay. So right there on the scene, we call that a teachable moment. We were explaining, oh, this person looks like they have either a bipolar illness or schizophrenia that's not being treated well. They're probably hearing things, a little bit paranoid. And really kind of some comfort is really what's needed. I don't think, it doesn't look like there's any physical things that we should have to worry about. In other words, physical endangerment of us as well as law enforcement. So let's calm the whole situation down. And really, this person really responded well to that. Law enforcement saw that, and they were just like, wow, that really worked well. And we made sure that it was a partnership between the EMTs, the fire department, and the police department, that we all agreed together what we were seeing. So that's part of our teachable moment that we will purposely do. So we're educating law enforcement as well as the fire department right there on the spot. So they'll remember this next time if they go out there, how to make this happen if our team is unavailable or they're handling the situation on their own.
We haven't talked too much about substance abuse, and that's part of what you do, and I'm guessing that that's a serious part of the kinds of emergency calls that one might get. What do you do? How are those calls different from other kinds of mental illness situations?
Well, the substance abuse, basically, it's the time that people can be the most erratic, quite frankly. When someone's mentally ill and they're not doing well, usually they'll lash out against their family members. That's the loved ones are the ones who get the brunt of physical domestic violence. With substance abuse, it's really where law enforcement has had the most danger of getting harmed by that individual. All the statistics and research shows that. So we're in the same situation going out to the scene. So we're a little bit more cautious, but we'll still engage. You know, we're not ones to say, oh, they're intoxicated, we can't talk to them. In fact, we're like, let's give it a try. A lot of times I just met with the team 2 days ago, and they're like, "Ooh, boy, these individuals who might be highly intoxicated, do they remember what we talked about?" I had to assure them that they remember something. They might not remember what we remember of the situation. But then I gave them the example of a case that the person, we had gone to the emergency room for follow-up linkage after a contact at the emergency room. The person was highly intoxicated. And our team still basically gave them our card. And I had to explain to our members of our mobile team, you know what happened 2 days later? And they're like, no, the person didn't remember anything. And we're like, no, quite the opposite. He showed up with this crumpled card from our agency, took the bus himself, and says, someone was talking to me. I don't know who they were. I have no idea why they were talking to me, but I thought I'd come over here to find out. Well, we were able to actually get them into services. So if anything, it was a cautionary tale that every encounter, people do remember, even if they're highly inebriated or on other substances. So if anything, we try to get them into our Presbyterian Medical Center services at the Santa Fe Community Guidance Center, because we do both mental health, substance abuse, as well as primary care, all in the same location right off Rodeo Park Drive West. So it gives you an idea that we can treat the whole person. So even intoxicants, we'll talk to them.
And Santa Fe County is very involved in prevention of substance abuse, prevention of suicide, and PMS is a great partner. We also partner with Santa Fe Recovery Center, with OI Recovery Center, and we work with the Santa Fe Prevention Alliance to do substance abuse and opiate overdose prevention work. All of these are kind of upstream approaches where we don't want to be pulling people out of the river downstream in the ER, in the jail. We want to really prevent them from getting there in the first place, whereas we used to have to do that kind of emergency intervention with our funds. Now we're able, because of a forward-thinking commission and a community that really supports, that we have to take a bigger view, a wider view, and start putting our resources, such as they are, to more upstream approaches.
I think it really is analogous in so many ways to the prevention of other kinds of illnesses. In other words, if you eat well and exercise, there's a lot of illnesses that you're not going to get. I was just talking to a good friend who is a cardiologist, and he had this kind of epiphany one moment when he was doing emergency surgery at 1 a.m. on somebody who clearly had spent a lifetime not taking care of himself, and realized that he wanted to go into a kind of medicine that was more about prevention. And with mental health, it's a similar thing.
I think, you know, part of how we look at that is by some of the good work that PMS is doing at the schools with school-based health centers to try to get to young people early on, that there is, as Mark said earlier, a lot of hope. There's a lot of treatment available for people if things are caught early on, especially. It can be helpful. And then we also know that, you know, it's a very, very tough illness, mental illness. And you can do all the right things as a family and as a community and still not prevent it. So we don't want to put that message out there. But I think that, we really need to think about this as a really important investment, not only for these individuals and these families, but our community as a whole, both in terms of public safety and also just in terms of who we want to be as a community. We want to be in Santa Fe, but, you know, different. So we should be different in that we really are thinking about ourselves as part of a whole.
Now, if somebody's listening right now and they are kind of noting down what they hear, and sometime later they might have an emergency in their own family and they want to access these mobile services, this mobile crisis response team, do they call 911? Can they call you directly? How does that work?
If it's a crisis, I would suggest call 911. We've coordinated quite well with the 911 system, whether they dispatch city members or sheriff's members throughout the county. So not to hesitate. If it's not a crisis and they want to get linked up to services, they can call. We have a local hotline throughout the county, which is 820-6333. We will answer their call, but what we're going to probably do is link them up to either Presbyterian Medical Services, the hospital, or another agency such as LifeLink in town to outpatient services if it's not a crisis situation, once again. So these are some of our resources. We also have Santa Fe Recovery Center for people who are battling substances here in town. So 911 would be your conduit for a crisis. Calling our hotline at 820-6333 for preventative linkage, we'd be glad to do that also.
And I would add that when people call 911, which I know a lot of family members can be hesitant to do, they just request the mobile crisis response team.
Right.
And they specifically ask for that. We're trying to raise awareness about the service in the community. And, 911 waits for a first responder or a family member to ask for that team. And that's the best way to go about it.
Kira Ochoa is Healthcare Assistance Program Manager for Santa Fe County. Mark Buscelli is a licensed mental health counselor and substance abuse counselor for Presbyterian Medical Services. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.